Welcome to this podcast from Christchurch London. For more information and resources, please go to christchurchlondon.org.
I imagine some of you are looking at this rather odd chair structure and thinking, what is going on? Some of you probably twigged it. Maybe some of you have read the passage, you've twigged what's going on and you've chosen your chair accordingly. And if you're listening on the podcast, you've got no idea, but the room looks a mess. Well, hopefully it will become apparent as we go on. So we saw last week that the book of Revelation is an apocalyptic book. It's about pulling back the curtain so you can see what's happening, so you can understand things from God's perspective and therefore interpret what is going on in history. And I think chapters 4 and 5 demonstrate this quite nicely. Because what we get in these chapters is a vision of heaven. And actually, if you look at chapter 6 onwards, which we'll look at next week, John starts to interpret world events in the light of what he has seen in heaven. But chapters 4 and 5 are really an insight into the inner workings of heaven. And so the passage begins with John being invited into heaven to see this experience. And because we're grappling with quite difficult language, I've argued that we shouldn't interpret everything over literally. Sorry, here, feel free to grab some handouts. But heaven, it's important that we understand what is meant by heaven in the book of Revelation and in Jewish and Christian literature and theology more broadly. So, heaven, we very often think of as being somewhere that is distant, that is far away, maybe up in the sky, or it's somewhere that we go when we die. But that's just not the way that the Bible uses the phrase heaven. The term heaven generally, well, sometimes it can simply mean the sky. At other times it means the place where God dwells, God's sphere of reality. And so when John is getting invited into heaven, we shouldn't see this as a picture of the place we will go one day when we die. Actually, when we get to the end of the book, we see that God's plan is for a new creation. And we'll get there in the final week. This is a picture of God's sphere of reality now. And John is being invited to see things from God's perspective. So he gets invited into heaven, and what we're going to read today, chapters 4 and 5, are heavily drawing on passages like Ezekiel 1 and Daniel 7 and Isaiah 6, which are three key passages which give us similar glimpses into heaven. This is a picture of what is going on in heaven now. Not what's going to happen at some point in the future, what is going on in heaven now. And what we're going to do is we're just going to work through it verse by verse. If you have Bibles, you might find it helpful to have them out, either on your phone or actual Bibles. It'd be good to follow along if possible. I'm not going to read every verse, and you might get puzzled if you don't follow them along. Okay, Revelation 4, verse 1. So we've seen about heaven. The phrase, what must happen after this, isn't necessarily referring chronologically to the events. So it's not saying the events of chapters 4 and 5 must happen chronologically after the previous events. Rather, it's referring to the order of the visions. So John has one vision, and then next he has another vision. And we can see this, we'll see this more as we go on through the next few weeks. But in chapters 7, 9, 15, 18, and 19, the same phrase is used to mean the next phase, the next sort of movement of the visions.
So
Tom? Do you mean in the sense of did it all take place in one time? Or I think we don't really know. It seems like there are breakpoints where John gets a new vision here and then a new vision here. It might be that it was one long one that's just sort of broken into movements like a symphony or something like that. Or it could be that they took place over a few times. I think actually chapter 1 tells us I was in the Spirit on the Lord's Day. So I'm inclined to think it's one big vision. But often the location of the vision changes. So he's had a vision, first of all, of the Son of Man walking amongst the churches. And now he has another vision which seems to have changed focus. And now he's looking to heaven. So I'd say probably different acts within one uber vision, as it were. So John describes being in the Spirit, which we saw last week refers to having some kind of prophetic experience. And the first thing he sees is a throne. Now, as we go through, we're going to find out that actually the picture of heaven is quite cluttered. Lots of different things going on. I mean, not cluttered in the sense it's a very small space and it's full. I mean, but there's lots going on. And yet the first thing he sees is a throne. The fact that we are immediately drawn to this picture of the throne indicates its central significance to these chapters. And actually, the throne is one of the major pictures in the whole book. It occurs 38 times from chapters 4 to 22, and 17 of those occurrences come in chapters 4 and 5. Last week we said that throne tends to represent, as you might expect, power and rulership and authority. So immediately we know that one of the key things that this chapter or these two chapters are going to talk about is rulership and authority. Verse 3, John tries to describe what he sees, but like Ezekiel and the other prophets, he can't describe the person of God accurately. So he describes things that he is like, and he likens this one on the throne to shining, vivid, coloured stones, which is a little bit odd. But he is drawing imagery from other texts like Exodus 28 and Ezekiel 1. And he lists precious stones like jasper, carnelian, and emerald, which, according to Exodus 28:13, are stones that are associated with Eden. So he seems to be calling to mind the idea of perfection and Eden right at the beginning of the Bible. Actually, when we get there in a few weeks' time, we'll find that in the new creation, these same stones and colours are actually built into the foundations and the walls of the new creation. So John seems to be alluding to something of that. Jasper can be many colours, but the most valuable type is green. And carnelian, on the other hand, is red. And some commentators say that red and green represent complementary colours. So here, John may be saying that God covers the full spectrum of beauty and glory. I don't know about that. It seems to be pushing the point a little further than we can be sure of. But, you know, it might be correct. But around the throne is a rainbow like an emerald. Now, this strikes me as a little bit strange, because rainbows, by their very nature, are full of lots of colours, and yet this is described as one colour, emerald green. It's not entirely clear why. All the commentaries give, well, most of them say we don't know why. Some of them try and make it look like they know why and give awful answers. So I don't really know why it's green, but the key thing, I think, is that it's a rainbow that surrounds the throne. Now, I want you to imagine this seating pattern as being something of a description of the heavenly scene. So in the centre here we have the throne, which I wouldn't let any of you speak on. I considered preaching from here, but then I thought that just seems a little bit arrogant. And around the throne we would have, obviously, jasper and carnelian. We would have a rainbow encircling the throne. Now, what biblically does a rainbow tend to represent? Covenant. Give me a key story in which a rainbow represents covenant.
The flood.
The Noah story. Okay, so you know the story. God floods the earth. At the end, he sets a rainbow in the sky, and he says, "This is a picture of my covenant. I will never again do this to the earth." So a rainbow is a picture of God's faithfulness and his commitment. So the fact that there is a rainbow around there, irrespective of the colour, indicates that we're meant to think of God's faithfulness, his commitment, and his covenant. Actually, interestingly, I said that the stones and the colours refer to Eden, which is creation, and the covenant, or the rainbow, represents covenant. And it seems that by combining the two together, John may well be trying to get you to think again about creation. And just as, like, when the flood subsided, we came into a new sort of creation, starting from scratch. So he seems to be coupling the idea of covenant and creation together to give you this vivid image that God is doing something that demonstrates his faithfulness to his promise and will result in new creation. Or something like that. Verse 4. Do feel free to chip in with questions as we go. Verse 4, we now begin widening the picture of the heavenly scene from the throne outwards. So you've got the throne in the centre, and then in verse 4 we learn that there are 24 elders sitting in a circle around the throne. Well done, you have chosen wisely. You are all elders. You people outside, I'll tell you what you are later. And you people in the middle, unlucky. Okay, so 24 elders around the throne. Now there's a lot of speculation as to what these elders are, what they represent. I think commonly when you see pictures of heaven, the throne tends to be surrounded by angels. So in Ezekiel 1 and Daniel 7 and Isaiah 6, which I would say are three key passages for understanding this chapter or two, we see that there are angels surrounding the throne. So the likelihood is you 24 people in the circle here are angels. But not just angels, there are 24 of you. And as we said last week, when the Bible or Revelation in particular uses numbers, it seems to do it in a particular way. And sometimes it takes numbers and multiplies them and adds them together. And it seems that 24 is 2 times 12. Yes, 2 times 12. And the reason is that 12 represents the 12 tribes of Israel in the Old Testament, and another 12 represents the apostles of the New Testament. So here, combining the two together means that we have angels that represent believers past and believers present. So the whole people of God, Old Testament and New Testament, are represented by angels who sit around this throne. Okay? This all feels a little bit complex and wading through treacle, but commentators largely agree on this, even if they're not sure if they're angels or what.
Yeah, that was my question. So the elders are angels.
Mm. Yeah. Obviously, we're not saying that Dave, Andy, and Ross, our elders in our church, are angels. I can vouch for the fact that they are not. but here they seem to be angelic figures. And we know that because Ezekiel 1, Daniel 7, Isaiah 6 seem to say angels surround the throne. Also, we'll see in a moment their dress sense is somewhat angelic, very white with crowns. They're seated on thrones, so positions of authority. But it's most likely that the elders, the angels, represent the whole people of God surrounding the throne. We'll come to the significance of that in a minute. But like I say, they are seated on thrones, which means they have at least some kind of power. Feel free to grab more chairs from the back and spread out anywhere you want, really. But they have crowns and they have thrones, which symbolize power, and their white robes symbolize purity. Verse 5, we're told that lightning, rumblings, and thunder emanate from the throne. These are things that demonstrate the power of God. And we'll see, particularly next week, that very phrase about lightning, rumblings, and thunder comes again and again and again throughout the book, particularly summing up the judgments that come on the earth. So it seems to be that John is saying all the judgments we're about to read of start off here at the throne of God. In other words, they're not just happening out of his control. All the stuff we're going to read about in human history starts with the rulership and authority of God. He then talks about the seven spirits of God being in front of the throne. I haven't demonstrated that because, again, I didn't really want people to sit in the chairs and represent the seven spirits of God. But somewhere roughly around where Ed is, there might be the seven spirits of God. Now, this doesn't mean seven gods. Seven, again, as we saw last week, means holiness, perfection, and completion. So it seems to be talking about the fullness of the presence of God before the throne. Verse 6. The sea of glass like crystal. Now, it's not entirely clear where it is, but it's roughly sort of, I guess, around here. There is this sea of glass surrounding the throne, and it's like crystal. And loads of people have given different interpretations as to what this means. Some people say it's like the ceiling of earth and the floor of heaven, so God can look through it and see what's going on below, as if he needed a window. I don't know, that seems a little far-fetched to me. And it doesn't really take account of how the phrase the sea is used, either in Jewish literature or in the book of Revelation, where I think it has a particular meaning. The sea in Jewish literature represents chaos and evil. So if you think about the Exodus story, we heard it this morning, Dave was talking about it in his sermon. The people come out of Egypt, and what is stopping them from crossing over towards the promised land is this sea. So they're standing there before the sea. That is separating them from where God is taking them, and their enemies are advancing. And so God has to part the sea so that they get rescued through the sea. And from that time on, the sea became an image of separation, hostility, chaos, and enmity. Revelation 15, which we'll see in a couple of weeks' time, uses almost identical imagery here to refer to the Red Sea. And in the prophets, the Red Sea is described as the place where beasts dwell. Isaiah 51, Psalm 74, Ezekiel 32, they allude to the Red Sea as the place of hostility or enmity. And in Daniel 7, verses 2 to 3, we get a very similar picture to this, and the beasts emerge from the sea to come up before God. So the sea in apocalyptic literature seems to be representative of chaos, disorder, and enmity. And if you've read to the end of the book, you will know in Revelation 21, it says that in the new creation, the sea is no more, which raises a big question, where do the fish live? If there are going to be animals in heaven, where do the fish dwell? I don't think it's saying there will be no large bodies of water. And I have reasons for thinking that. In Isaiah, it talks about the new creation with people coming in their ships. Where are they going to come if there's no sea? So I don't think it's literally saying there's no sea. I think it's saying that chaos and disorder and enmity will be utterly done away with in the new creation. We'll come to that properly in a couple of weeks' time. But I think the significance here of saying there is a sea of glass like crystal at the feet of God, it's saying this: the enmity, the chaos, the hostility is under God's feet and by his throne. He is in charge of it. And here, the sea is described as being like crystal, as in it's clear, it's calm. And John seems to be trying to evoke the idea that God is utterly in control. God is calming evil and hostility now, but one day he will do away with it entirely. It's utterly under his control. Does that make sense? Cool. Verses 6 to 7. On each side of the throne are four beasts. We have more than four beasts in the centre now, but that's okay. You're welcome anyway. The four beasts, there is a lion, there is an ox, there is an eagle, and there is a man. Can anyone remember from last week, what does four represent? Four corners of the earth. Four corners of the earth, yep. So it's kind of worldwideness. Yeah. So the fact that we have four beasts seems to be referring to the fact that these four in some way represent worldwideness, completion, the whole of creation. And actually the four of them each represent the king of their species. So in the ancient world, these were thought of as being four particular representative creatures. The lion is the king of the wild beasts. The ox is the king of the tamed beasts. The eagle is the king of the birds. And man is the pinnacle of God's creation. So these four beasts surrounding the throne represent the whole of God's created order. And they sing this song of worship, which we'll see. Actually, we might as well turn there now. Someone's got a Bible open. Would you turn to Isaiah 6 and read verses 1 to 3? Okay, so we've got these creatures. They have six wings. They have eyes. They are singing this song, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty." And we're told that these beasts here equally have six wings. Seems to be an allusion to Isaiah 6. They're also singing a song which is very similar to that of Isaiah 6. And what John seems to be doing here is saying this is the whole of creation doing what it was intended to do, to sing the age-old song about the holiness and power and wonder of God. Creatures are covered with eyes. Verse 7 says they are in front and behind, and verse 8 says they are all around and within. So quite what it would look like to have eyes inside you would be quite peculiar. But there we go. They seem to have them outside, all around them, and within. In other words, no part of the creatures, or no part of anything, goes unseen by the creatures. They see everything going on around them. And we're told that they sing night and day, i.e. they never sleep, they never close their eyes. And the song that they sing is the song that the angels have always sung throughout history and will continue to sing. And what happens is that when the creatures worship, I won't get you to act it out, this would just get a bit silly and you'd have to have multiple eyes. But when the creatures worship, then the elders around bow down. And so we kind of get this, it's like throwing a stone into a pond, this ripple. Something happens in the middle, the creatures who represent the whole created order bow down and worship and sing this song. And then you 24 elders who represent all the people of God, past and present, also bow down and worship. So this is telling us that in heaven right now, there is worship going on. Now, worship leaders are very keen on telling you that you will spend forever worshipping. I think they've got a vested interest in that. As I say, this is not a picture of what we will do for eternity, though I do hope there are some oxes with multiple eyes. I'd love to see multiple, more than two, all over. That would be quite cool to see, and oxes with wings as well. That would be amazing. But this is not a picture of what we will do in the future so much as it's a picture of what is going on now in heaven. There is unity and there is praise and there is worship rippling out from the center where God sits. And we're told that God is eternal. These verses draw, they repeatedly talk about his eternity. He was and is to come. He lives forever. He created everything. The creatures and elders sing the same song that we hear in Isaiah 6. And note, there's been nothing said here about the cross. Nothing said about Jesus yet. Nothing said about his death and his resurrection. Just you are worthy, you are eternal, you are holy. Which tells me this. Even before the cross, which is undoubtedly the supreme act of God breaking in, God was utterly worthy to be worshipped. We'll see in a moment that there is a new song that comes. They change their tune a little bit, as it were. But even before we think about the cross, God is eternally worthy to be praised. He is eternal. He doesn't change. He is the creator and sustainer of all things. And the elders cast their crowns down before God, indicating that even the little bit of authority they do have is ultimately subjected to him. And this seems to repeat again and again and again, possibly through history, and they don't seem to tire of it, because they are bowled over by the awesomeness of God and they worship him. Does that make sense? Any questions? No. Okay. That's Revelation 4, very, very quickly. And the elders fall down. And beautiful musical interlude. Thank you. Okay. That was very fast. Let's go to Revelation 5. So the creatures are worshipping, the elders are worshipping. And then we're told that the one seated on the throne has a scroll or a book in his right hand. Now, people have interpreted this a number of ways, and loads of commentaries have loads of different ideas of what the scroll or the book represents. Some people say it represents the Lamb's Book of Life, i.e. the book that contains the names of all people who are to be saved by God. And we do read about that in Revelation, and I think in your notes you've got a list of references. But that doesn't seem to be quite right for a number of reasons. Firstly, we're actually told in Revelation 20 there are other books. There are lots of books, even before the Lamb's book gets opened. So we're not necessarily bound to thinking that this book in the right hand of the Holy One is the Lamb's Book of Life. It may be something slightly different. Actually, Daniel 7 and Ezekiel 1-3, I think, are the background for understanding this passage. And when they talk about these scrolls or these books, it tends to mean something that contains an idea of judgment and future acts of God that will bring punishment and restoration on the earth. Also, we'll see next week that when the scrolls are opened, particular things happen. So it seems most likely that this scroll here represents the future of mankind and the earth and everything. In it is contained information about God's plan to restore the world and to put it to rights. But it's not simply information. Actually, the opening of it enacts God's act upon the world. Let me just make a comment about judgment. Because judgment is one of those words that when you're talking through Revelation, inevitably you have to use a lot. And like any word you use a lot, you can become very familiar with it, and it just sort of rolls off the tongue. But actually, judgment obviously is not a very easy or pleasant word. And so I want us just to be very clear what I mean when I talk about judgment. You see, next week we're going to look at the seals, the trumpets and the bowls, and we will use this word judgment left, right and centre. And actually, typically people think of it as a very negative word. So we think about people being judgmental, and that seems to carry an idea of maybe being arbitrary or prejudice or that sort of thing. That is not how I mean to use the word judgment in this series. Actually, I think the overwhelming theme of the book of Revelation is that God is putting his world to rights. And so judgment in that context means less about simply punishing people, although it may mean that as well, and more about God doing justice. In fact, that's probably a better way of putting it. God doing justice in the world. Now imagine that you had been, I don't know, wronged somehow and you went to court. You would be expecting a level of justice for the judge to do something, to cast judgment. And there, actually, it's not a wholly negative picture, the idea of judgment. It depends very much where you stand. If you are the victim, then judgment being cast or judgment being done is actually a good thing for you, because it means that justice is done. People are held to account for the things they have done wrong, and the victim is somehow restored or given what he is due. And I think that's worth bearing in mind when we think about judgment in the light of this book. It's not predominantly about God wanting to punish lots of people. It's about God making all things right. And just as in a courtroom scene, doing justice or passing judgment involves giving positive things to one person and also holding wrongdoers to account, so too in the book of Revelation, the idea of judgment has both of those elements. For victims, for the oppressed, for the people that John is writing to who are facing oppression and persecution and possibly martyrdom, the idea of judgment may actually be a positive thing for them to long for. Not that they are longing in a bloodthirsty kind of way for God to do awful things to awful people, but they are longing for God to put the world to rights, bring an end to their suffering, and give them justice where they're currently facing injustice. Does that make sense? It's very important that we understand that. In fact, one of the things that people often think about the book of Revelation, and one of the things that puts people off the book of Revelation, is that it can seem like God is a heartless, cruel, malicious kind of person. I want to propose that God has to deal with evil and suffering and injustice in the world if he is to be good. And so the fact that we see him punishing wrongdoing is actually essential for God to be good. Because if God were simply to look at the earth and say, there is stuff going on here that is corrupting the earth, that is destroying community and goodness and truth and all the things that I put into the earth, but I'm going to turn a blind eye, then God would not be good. The fact that God takes evil seriously and does something about it, I think, is essential to his goodness. And I think probably all people, Christian, non-Christian, people of other faiths, people of no faith, do long deep down for justice. They long for right things to be done. The problem is that none of us wants a sort of justice that has negative effects on us. And so most of us tend to think, well, there are evil people in the world. There are people that do wrong things in the world. And if God would simply punish them, then we other people could get on with our lives and that would be wonderful and glorious. But that's too simplistic. Just dividing the line and saying, well, there's us and them. It doesn't work like that. In fact, you probably heard this quote, but Alexander Solzhenitsyn, I can't say his name, Solzhenitsyn says this: if only it were all so simple. If only there were evil people somewhere insidiously committing evil deeds, and it were necessary only to separate them from the rest of us and destroy them. But the line dividing good and evil runs through the heart of every human being. And who is willing to destroy a piece of his own heart? It's a famous quote, and what I love about that is it stops us being simplistic about how we think of good and evil in the world. It's very easy to think there are other people who do bad and we do good. And if God would only deal with them, then the rest of the world would be fine. But actually that quote, and I would say the testimony of the whole of Scripture, tells us that each of us is capable of doing things that displease God. Each of us is capable of being part of the problem that corrupts this world that God has created. And so if justice is to be done, if things are to be restored, that has effects on all of us. It means that those who persistently refuse to take forgiveness and acceptance and restoration from God may find themselves to be in the place of the wrongdoer, needing to be dealt with in order for good to be done. But those of us who put our trust in God And Jesus' death on our behalf and his resurrection find forgiveness, and we suddenly find ourselves in a place we never deserved to be. Promised justice and goodness and a place in the new creation. Forgiven for our part in corrupting this world that God has given us. And so judgment and justice has this kind of dual edge to it. On the one hand, it's positive. On the other, it's bitter. And if you were to read on to chapter 10, you'll find there's a little picture there where John is given a scroll to eat, which must have been a bit weird. You serious? You want me to eat this book? That's a bit strange. But he eats the book. It's not this book. It's a different book. A different scroll. But as he eats it, we are told that it is sweet in his mouth and bitter in his stomach. And I think that's a picture of how judgment is. When we talk about things like Revelation, on the one hand, I want to see the hope and the joy in it. On the other hand, I have to live up to the fact that it says some awful things are going to happen. And they will have effects on those who persistently play the role of the wrongdoer against God's purpose. And that is sobering, but it's also hope-giving. It's bitter and it's also sweet. And we've got to remember both those things as we talk about judgment. Otherwise, we end up treating it as just something that's going to happen to other people. And we become heartless and hard and cold. Whereas this book is about God putting the world to rights. And the question we have to ask is, where are we in the picture? Are we those who are trusting in his redemptive plan? Or are we those who are thwarting his redemptive plan? Does that make sense? Any questions on any of that? That's a bit of an abstract, extended homily on judgment. But I think it's helpful to know that before we get into the bowls and the trumpets. Otherwise, it will seem like God is malicious. Whereas really, God is restoring all things. And it's a glorious, hope-filled, wonderful picture. Okay, that's too long. Chapter 5, verse 2. In fact, verses 2 to 4. If we understand the contents of the scroll as being God's plan for restoring all things and doing away with evil once and for all, then we can understand why when John looks around and there's no one that's able to open it, he cries. I don't know if you've ever read that before and thought John is just being a little bit petulant. Like, he's not allowed to look into someone else's book and so he cries. I mean, it can feel a little bit sort of, what's the big deal? I mean, it's just like it'll get opened eventually. But when you understand what is in the scroll, this is God's plan for restoring all things, then the fact that no one can be found in heaven or on earth that is worthy to open the scroll is utterly devastating. Because if that scroll doesn't get opened, evil will win the day. People who are perpetrating injustice will get away with it, and victims will never have any kind of restoration. And ultimately, God would either be powerless or evil. So John weeps at the idea that this scroll cannot be opened. And then verse 5, we get this incredible hope-giving verse. It says, "One of the elders said to me, 'Weep no more. Behold, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has conquered so that he can open the scroll and its seven seals.'" There are some quite amazing but complex Old Testament prophecies in there, which we'll look at in just a second. But this scroll is sealed with seven seals. Given that we've talked about various beasts, it might be tempted to think of the seals as creatures. They're not, you know, art seals. They're, you know, wax-stuck seals. They are seals that stick the scroll together so that you cannot open it. And in the ancient world, seals were used to protect the contents of a document so that you couldn't know what was in it, but more importantly, you couldn't change it. And the opening of the seals doesn't simply mean, everyone can now understand what's in the document. The opening of the seals involves the enactment of the document. So say it was a legal document or a will, for example, it will be kept sealed until the day it was meant to be opened and acted upon. And so here we are told that the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has conquered so that he can open the scroll and its seven seals. In other words, this one will not simply get to know what's in the book, he will be able to bring it into action. And John uses two Old Testament prophecies, which we shall look at. Do you have Genesis 49, a bit of that on your notes? Yep. Could someone read out those verses from Genesis 49? This is Jacob blessing his sons, and this is his blessing over Judah. Could someone read that for us?
Jacob blessed Esau, and Esau blessed Jacob. Judah's a lion's cub. From the prey of your son, you've gone up. He stooped down, he crouched as a lion, and as a lioness. Who dares rise him? Scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until the tribune comes to him. And to him shall be the obedience of the peoples.
Okay, so we get this passage here, which gives us the idea of this lion of Judah. That someone from the line of Judah will be best described as a lion, a powerful, kingly person. It talks about the scepter, it talks about people bowing to him, bringing him tribute. And this seems to be a prophecy that the king, to rule over Israel and then eventually the nations, would come through the line of Judah. And he will be described as a lion. Actually, the lion is a key picture in apocalyptic literature. So if you looked at other texts that are outside the Bible, they regularly talk about the lion attacking the eagle, and this seemed to be a representative of kings attacking other nations. So the lion is a picture of strength and rulership. And we'll come back to see what John does with that in a moment. But that's the first Old Testament prophecy. The second comes from Isaiah 11, which is really quite a baffling passage, actually, Isaiah 11. In chapter 10 of Isaiah, it talks about God humbling the arrogant and the proud. And it uses this picture of God chopping them down like trees in a forest. And then Isaiah 11 opens with this. There shall come forth a shoot from the stump of Jesse, and a branch from his roots shall bear fruit. So carrying on this idea of people being chopped down like trees, it then says out of this stump or this trunk of Jesse, who was David's father in the Old Testament, shall come a shoot or a branch that bears fruit. And this is a prophecy about the coming Messiah, the anointed one, the king who would lead Israel in the way that God intended. And we're told that this shoot or this branch comes out of the stump of Jesse. In other words, this shoot, this Messiah, is going to come forth from the line, the family of Jesse. There are a couple of things to notice about this. When the kings are listed again and again and again in the books of Kings, it always refers to them, or it regularly refers to them, in relation to David, who was seen to be the king par excellence, the guy that people were trying to model themselves around. And so it will refer to people as being like David. No king is ever described as being a son of Jesse, except David, who actually was Jesse's biological son. But here, we are told that this shoot will not simply be in the line of David, but in the line of Jesse. Now, that may sound just a little bit, you know, so what? But I think what Isaiah is trying to say here is, we are not just expecting another king in the line of David. I mean, we could have loads of those. We are expecting a new David. Not just another king who happens to be in that family tradition, a new David. He'll come forth like a shoot. But then, if you read forward to Isaiah 11:10, it says this. In that day, the root of Jesse. Now, he suddenly changed the imagery from a shoot to a root. Obviously quite different. But he says, in that day, the root of Jesse, who shall stand as a signal for the peoples, of him, so we know he's talking about a person, of him shall the nations inquire, and his resting place shall be glorious. So the imagery has changed from a shoot which grows out of a stump to now a root which presumably predated the stump. Doesn't that sound a little bit odd to you? I have no idea what people would have made of this when they were reading it in Isaiah's day. This is a riddle that people had no answer to in the Old Testament. It seems to be talking about a Messiah figure who would come forth from Jesse, but also predate Jesse and undergird the whole Messianic line. Does that seem a little odd to you? Or are you okay with that? I mean, are you just used to predating your father? And you know, I mean, it's a little bit strange, and people would have had no idea what to do with it, but Jesus says that he is the root of Jesse. But we also know that he is the shoot. He is the one who came forth, who was the true Messiah, and yet Jesus also says that in some strange kind of way, he predated Jesse. He is the root and the shoot, which is somewhat baffling. It's kind of similar to what Jesus says in John 8, where he says, before Abraham was, I am. In other words, think back to your father Abraham, and I, who am speaking to you today, somehow undergird him. I predate him. Here we get an odd picture of Jesus' pre-existence and his power. He is the true Messiah who the whole messianic line was pointing towards, but also he was the one on whom the messianic line was even modeled. It's really confusing and baffling, but then particularly in Revelation 22, he combines these two images together. He says, I am the root and the descendant of David. Anyway, back to Isaiah 11. The main point about Isaiah 11 is that this one who would come would restore all of creation. And so if you were to read Isaiah 11, particularly between verses 1 and 10, you see all these pictures of animals living in harmony, humans living in harmony with the rest of creation in this new creation. So, John combines two pictures together. The Lion of Judah and the Root of Jesse. And here's the significance. In Genesis, we know at the beginning that man was created to be a ruler, to rule and have dominion over the earth. At the fall, man gave that up, and so God promises that he will send someone of the line of Judah who will be like a lion, full of authority and kingly rule, who would restore back that authority that we had given up. But he's not simply like a lion, he's also like the root of Jesse, who comes not only to deal with the corruption of man, but the corruption that man has brought upon the earth. So by combining these two images together into one person, Jesus is being described as the one who will deal with sin in humans, but also restore all of creation in one go. Do you see that? Does that make sense? I mean, it kind of doesn't make sense because these are things that we can't get our heads around. But this is a lofty claim that Jesus has always existed. And Jesus is God's plan both to restore man but also restore the world. And John, having heard this, turns round to see this person they're talking about. Now, having heard that description, you may go for it. To the lion root thing. Yeah, go for it.
If it's relevant, or if not, that's fine. But use of the word stump in Isaiah, and that it's got negative connotations.
Predominantly negative.
And
yeah.
What's relevant in Revelation?
Yeah, I think it's predominantly negative, particularly given that Isaiah 10 is talking about lopping down trees so that you've just got stumps left. So it's the stump appears to be a small remnant of what was once a glorious thing. And I think that that's the point, that the messianic line from Jesse onwards, it was okay, but it was never actually the full glorious thing that God intended. And yet out of this almost wreck of a lineage, God managed to bring a new shoot and therefore a new sense of hope. So yeah, I think the stump is very relevant. It's not just a trunk, it's a wasted stump. Yeah. Okay. So John is excited about seeing this lion figure, and he turns round to see the lion, and I don't know what you would be expecting, probably actually seeing a lion, but he turns around and what he sees just shocks him. Because it's not a lion, it's not a victorious figure, it's not like some kind of person with a crown or a warrior, he sees a lamb. Lambs are not the most victorious, warlike, aggressive, regal kind of animals you are likely to see. Especially not this one, because this one looks like it's been killed. It's like this slaughtered lamb. It's a weak creature, and it's an even weaker, weak creature because it looks like it has been slaughtered. But John's very specific. He's not dead. He's not lying. He is standing. So there is a sense in which this lamb has somehow overcome death. This has big implications. Firstly, it challenges us about what we think about Messiah. Bear in mind that many of the Jews were expecting a warrior figure who would literally come and overthrow the Romans, a powerful person. And yet when John sees this person, he's depicted as weak, even dead, but then made alive. It challenges us as to how we think about power. What is true power? Is it might and aggression? Or is it something else, something more self-sacrificing? Big questions, which maybe we'll pick up as we go through. But here Jesus looks utterly unlike how John expects. And the famous author D.H. Lawrence, who was very much not a Christian, and yet wrote a commentary on Revelation, which is one of the weirdest books you could ever read, definitely not recommended. He describes it like this: "The Lion of Judah put on a fleece, but by his bite ye shall know him." In other words, Jesus is being deliberately deceptive here. He's really an aggressive lion, but he dresses up like a slaughtered lamb in order to fool people and kind of get them to not recognize how powerful he is. He's utterly missed the point. It's not the case that Jesus is being deceptive here and he's got all this power, but he's hiding it under a fleece. No, 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 no. This is true power. This is true rulership and authority, having power and yet giving it up and going to your death for others. Jesus is the lion, but he comes as a lamb. In fact, George Caird puts it like this. I think this is probably the most helpful description of what's going on here that I've read. He says, "This title, the lamb, is meant to control and interpret all the rest of the symbolism. It's almost as if John was saying to us at this point, at one point after another, whenever the Old Testament says lion, read lamb. Wherever the Old Testament speaks about the victory of the Messiah or the overthrow of the enemies of God, we are to remember that the gospel recognizes no other way of achieving these ends than the way of the cross." So it's not that Jesus isn't the Lion of Judah, but rather the fact that John sees a lamb when he expects a lion means that we have to reinterpret everything we know about true power and the way in which God is going to deal with the brokenness of the world. He doesn't come like a lion just storming in and tearing up his enemies. He comes as a self-giving lamb. This is pointing to the cross. The death and resurrection of Jesus is the thing ultimately that changes and restores the world. The way in which God is going to put the world to rights is not through violence done to the world predominantly, but by violence done to God himself. But still there is a sense in which the lamb has power, so he has seven horns. We saw last week, again, seven means completion or fullness. Horns refer to power. And the lamb does have power, but what's important is the way in which he uses his power. And we're told that he looks like he has been slaughtered. The word translated slaughtered is the Greek word sphatso, which particularly means a particularly violent form of death. There are other words that could have been used. Tuo is a key word that is used, but sphatso is chosen here, and there seem to be a number of reasons for it. It's saying that this slaughtering of the lamb has been particularly violent and gruesome. And it's a key word that calls to mind Isaiah 53, 4-7, a famous passage. "Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions, he was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace, and with his wounds we are healed. All we, like sheep, have gone astray, we have turned everyone to his own way. And the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. Like a lamb that is led to the slaughter, and like a sheep that before his shearers is silent, he opened not his mouth." So rather than simply saying, "is a lamb who had been killed," he's saying, "this is a lamb who has been slaughtered." And he's calling to mind Isaiah 53. "He has been slaughtered so that you might have forgiveness and peace." Verse 9, however, talks about ransoming people, which is the language of purchasing them from slavery, like in the Passover. If you were a Jew and you heard the word ransom, you would think predominantly of the Exodus story, being set free from slavery in Egypt. That's reinforced by the fact that in verse 10 talks about a kingdom of priests, which is a particular Exodus phrase in Exodus 19. So here, he's drawing our mind back to the Exodus. And of course, the lamb also played a role in the Exodus story. Because by having the lamb slaughtered and his blood spread over the doorposts, we were set free. So Jesus, in his violent death, has been a sacrifice to forgive us from our sins, but he's also been the sacrifice that set us free. Both of those in one person. Go for it.
In verse 8.
Yeah.
So each one had a harp and golden balls in it.
Yes.
What does the harp and the golden balls
Yeah, good question. Sorry, I did skip that for a reason, and it's not just that I don't know what's going on there. we will. That was a great way of fobbing you off and seeming clever at the same time. Of course I know what's going on there. I did it deliberately. No, we'll come to that. So next week, what we're going to look at is the seals, the trumpets, and the bowls, and we'll see what the bowls are and the incense and that sort of thing. So we will come to that. But in this lion-lamb picture, we have Jesus depicted in three ways. He is liberating, like the Passover sacrifice. He is atoning, like the Isaiah 53 sacrifice, but he's also conquering, like the messianic lion. But there seems to be one other reason why this word spatzo is used over others, like tuo, and it's this. It's the same word that is also used later on to describe the deaths of the martyrs in chapter 6 and 18. So John seems to be linking the church's own experience, those who are facing martyrdom, with that of their Christ, in order to say, if you want to overcome, you need to be faithful to God and his plan, just as Christ was faithful to God and his plan. Overcoming doesn't come by power, it comes by trusting in Jesus and his victory through the cross. One final thing about the lamb. Think about where the lamb is standing in this picture. He's probably standing, he's standing by the throne. And we said earlier that here in front of the throne is the sea of glass like crystal. So the lamb is either standing on or by the sea, which represents the fact that his victory is over the beasts that come out of the sea. So the lamb who looks like he has been slain is actually full of power and authority over the beasts who are to come out of the sea later on in the book. So the lamb approaches the throne, he takes the scroll, and once again worship emanates through the whole order, rippling out from the centre with the four creatures and then the elders falling down in worship. As I say, we'll see about the bowls of incense next week. But this whole section here seems to be patterned on Daniel 7, 13 to 14. I think, again, you've got that in your notes. Could someone read that passage for us?
I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the cloud of heaven, there came one like the Son of Man, and he came to the Ancient of Days, and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion and glory and kingdom, that all people, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed.
Okay, so in Daniel 7, you've got a very similar picture where this one like a son of man, which we saw last week, refers to Jesus in chapter 1 of Revelation. He approaches the throne where the Ancient of Days is sitting, and he receives power and dominion and authority. And here we see the same thing is true of the Lamb. He approaches the throne and he receives this scroll, which represents power and dominion and authority and the ability to have power over the rest of history. So John is telling us that the picture in Daniel is now coming through in Jesus. And then we are told that the people sing a new song. Remember, previously they'd sung an old song, a song that had been sung for centuries and centuries. Angels had always been singing it. Now they sing a new song. And if you look in the Old Testament, when new songs are sung, they are sung for two reasons. Either to celebrate God's creation, or to thank him for victory over an enemy. And here, again, it seems like the two are combined. Jesus is the ruler who has overcome enemies, but he's also the root of Jesse who brings about new creation. And so because of the death and resurrection and ascension of Jesus, now this age-old song gives way to a new song, which recognises not simply that God is eternal and God has always been good and creator, but he has also come decisively in the person of Jesus and now will bring about the new creation. This is like a dividing line in history. We sang an old song previously. Now our song is shaped and changed by the knowledge of Jesus' death and resurrection. Verses 9 to 10, this is what they sing. Worthy are you to take the scroll and open its seals, for you were slain, and by your blood you ransomed people for God from every tribe and language and people and nation. And you have made them a kingdom and priests for our God, and they shall reign on the earth. I said last week that fourfold phrase, every tribe, language, people and nation, by being fourfold, four being the number of completeness and worldwideness, is talking about the fact that he's not just going to have a tribe and language and people and nation from one small corner of the earth. It's going to be a global, worldwide thing. God is drawing all people to himself through Jesus' blood. Because of the cross, the gospel is now open wide to people from any nationality who trust in his death and resurrection. And notice this as well. It says, you have made them a kingdom and priests to our God. Now that might not sound too controversial to us, because we're very used to churches where people serve all the time and people do stuff and you can contribute on a Sunday and people preach and people bring words of encouragement and people lead worship. We're used to the idea of ministry, of being in a sense priests. But if you were a Jew, this would be radical for you. Because in Judaism, not everyone got to be priests. It was only one tribe, the Levites, who got to minister to and for the Lord. And so now, being told not simply other Jews get to do it as well, but people from every nation get to be priests, is mind-blowing. God is opening up to all people the ability to come close to him and to serve him in a way that it was previously restricted. Also, I like this, in the Old Testament, the kings and the priests were kept separate, and there were rules about bringing them together. So kings were not allowed to officiate as their own priests. They were forbidden from doing so, and there are two stories in 1 Samuel 13 and 2 Chronicles 26 of Saul and Uzziah, who both disobeyed this command. They were kings who then acted as priests, and they get punished for doing so. There's a sort of separation of powers in the Old Testament. But now Jesus is depicted as being both our great high priest and our king. And he is making a people who are both kingly and priestly. In other words, in the new kingdom, there is no separation of powers. He has it all. And he is making a people who are both able to rule with authority and minister to and for God as well. He is going far beyond what the Old Testament was ever able or allowed to do. Verse 11. So we've seen again and again that worship starts in the center, like a stone being thrown into water and rippling out. And again, we see it happen. Something happens in the center. They sing about the lamb who has now taken the scroll. It ripples out, so the ox and eagle and lion and man. I haven't decided which of you represents each, but I've got some ideas, but I'm not going to say for fear of offending you. So it emanates out to Ed the ox, and you're definitely the lion. No, I'm going to stop. Okay, so it emanates out from the center to the created order, then to all the people who represent Old Testament and New Testament believers, and then it goes one stage further as well, and we are told there are thousands and thousands and myriads of angels gathering around this community, and they worship as well. So you guys at the back, you chose good seats. You don't get to worship until last, but you're angels, okay? So it emanates out. So when we think about heaven, this is a place where everyone worships. Worship permeates the whole thing, starting in the middle and going right out. And this idea of thousands and thousands of angels surrounding the throne comes through in chapters like Daniel 7 again. Thousands of angels worshiping, joining in.
Hmm. You mentioned that the elders were also angels.
Yeah, yeah.
So is there something sort of special or different about that?
Yes, so I would say that the angels, the elders surrounding the throne, there are particularly 24 of them, which means they represent something that these others don't. Mm. And many commentators would say the thing they represent is the people of God in the Old and New Testament. So angels have particular functions, I suppose, throughout Scripture. It seems that some have different functions to others, and without going into it too much, I think these ones represent people in a way that the others don't. They're more sort of lower tier angels, I don't know. but there seems to be some kind of difference in the things that they represent.
So you could just say 24 angels, really, because he obviously uses the
instead of elders?
Yes,
they could have done, yes. Yeah, I mean, elder, the word elder connotes a number of things like age and authority as well, so it may be that he wants us to know that these 24 have a particular authority that the others don't. That might be something of it, yeah. I should say as well that it's not essential that we think that these 24 elders represent angels. That does seem to be a fairly strong consensus, and I'm happy with that. But also, you do get things in the New Testament where we're told we are seated with Christ now in the heavenly realms, and it could well be that these 24 elders represent people being seated with Christ in the heavenly realms. I'd be happy with that. I think you've got the same sort of imagery there, 12 and 12, meaning Old Testament and New Testament people. Yeah, but I think their description seems a little more angelic than I currently am, for example. So, yeah. Okay, verse 13. Every creature in heaven and on the earth sings in praise. And the praise is shared by the one who sits on the throne and the Lamb. And this is just a strong and beautiful, quite overt picture of the deity of Jesus. Praise and worship is given to him from all creation and all angels, which implies that he is equal to God. So you have the Father seated on the throne and the Lamb standing next to him, and both of them receive this song of praise. So, we've worked through these chapters pretty fast. That was incredibly quick. And I think they paint a scene of the inner workings of heaven. We understand that heaven is a place where things operate correctly, where there isn't dissension and argument and disobedience, but all things and all creatures worship God as they were intended to. I don't think this is a picture of the future, like some futurists might. It doesn't seem to make a lot of sense to me to think that right now Jesus is not there in a position of authority, but one day he will be. It seems to be more a statement of the fact that now the ascended Jesus is standing there in a position of authority. So think of Philippians 2, where it says that because Jesus was obedient to death, God has now exalted him to a place of authority so that all people in heaven and earth will worship him. That seems to be what's going on here. So if we think now, what is going on in the sphere of God, where God dwells, right now Jesus is being worshipped and glorified and he stands in a position of authority. Actually, what we'll see is that at the moment he is left here at the end standing next to the throne. In Revelation 22, he actually shares the throne. If we were to look at verses 1 and 3 of Revelation chapter 22, it describes the throne not as the throne of the Father by which the Lamb stands, but it's now described as the throne of God and the Lamb. So throughout the whole book of Revelation, it seems to depict this thing from the ascension where Jesus walks into heaven, is given authority to enact all the rest of God's plan for mankind, and the book ends in the new creation with the Lamb and the Father sitting together on the throne, receiving equal praise. And that seems to be a nice trajectory that runs throughout the whole book. So how does this book help us, or how does this chapter help us to think about things now? Well, we'll see next week that from this position, now understanding what's going on in heaven, John is able to interpret the seal judgments and the bowl judgments and the trumpet judgments. But it's only when you understand what is going on in heaven that we can begin to piece together and understand what is going on in the world. See, if you just look around the world and think this is a bit bleak, I don't really know what's going on, sometimes it feels like things are out of control, then you haven't really got Revelation 4 and 5. Because so many bits of this chapter are trying to hammer home the point that God is in control. He is seated on the throne. No one else is seated on the throne. The sea, the place where the beasts come from, is at his feet. And it's calm at his feet. And one day it will be no more. Jesus have overcome through his death. He's not a dead lamb. He's not a weak lamb. He is a lamb who is standing. He has horns. He has power. And all people are worshipping him. This is a hope-giving chapter, because it tells us that God is in charge. If you were one of the early readers of Revelation going through awful things, you would have been thinking, our churches are being persecuted, it's likely that we'll face martyrdom, how can we understand this? The only way you understand it is by knowing that everything comes from the throne of God. He is in charge of everything. And for us now, it doesn't simply mean, like many worship leaders would like us to think, that one day we will sing and throw down our crowns and worship. We will worship in heaven. But it's far more dynamic than that. We're going to get a new creation, like a new world made brand new. This is a picture of what is happening right now. And it's meant to encourage and give us hope in all that we do and all that we face. So, quite simply, as I said last week, if I were to sum up the book of Revelation in two words, again, I would say this chapter, Jesus wins. Jesus wins. He's in charge. He totally rules. He has all the power. He is the lion, a powerful and victorious conqueror, but he is the lamb. His power is not like the power we see wielded by untrustworthy people or malicious dictators here and now. He conquers by giving of himself, taking on the pain and brokenness of this world. He is the Passover lamb who sets us free from captivity. He is the sacrificial lamb who takes away our sin and allows us to have a right relationship with God. He is the root and the shoot. He existed before Jesse and David, and yet he is the one that they were pointing to as well. And he has come to make new all of creation and rid it of its brokenness.
Thank you for listening. For more information or for further podcasts and downloads, please visit christchurchlondon.org.